If you want to get your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 200. It's our bicentennial. Happy New Year, Matt.
Happy New Year.
And so we're going to discuss a few things. This will probably be a pretty short episode. Again, to all of our listeners, Happy New Year. Lots of new things coming in 2022. Hopefully Matt and I will get a little YouTube content put up. And maybe a little more participation from some of the other Gizmo Sapiens. It's a busy world out there, as everybody's having to try to make a little bit extra money since the economy is in the crapper. But, you know, let's discuss a few things. So, I guess the kind of the biggest going on right now, it went on. This last week was CES 2022. It was both an in-person and an online event. They believe that they're only going to get 30 to 50% attendance from their pre-COVID numbers, which is pretty impactful. I found the same thing. For my real work money job, we went to Supercomputing back in November, the week before the week of Thanksgiving. And it was the same thing. It was kind of a ghost town. It was actually a great environment to do a little business, you know, talk to some of our partners and talk to some prospective partners. There weren't a whole lot of customers around. But usually it's so busy you can't sit down and talk business. You know, you're there and you do a meet and greet, and you might be able to, if you're looking at some new technologies, you might be able to ask a few questions, but you're not going to really get a whole lot of one-on-one time. And I think that's probably what happened at CES, that a lot of vendors, a lot of business got done, but it wasn't customer or, you know, retailer or customer to, customer-facing business. It was business to business. I got to say it at least six times. One of the funny things about CES, and probably the biggest thing that was notable about it, is that Apple does not participate in CES, hasn't for more than 20 years at this point. Yet they were the biggest star of the show because probably 90% of the people showing technologies were technologies related to HomeKit and security with HomeKit and all things Apple in that Apple environment. And so it's kind of interesting to see that that ecosystem grow, and it's a good thing that it's growing because of all the ecosystems out there, Apple's is the most privacy focused. It's not perfect, but they try to do what Google says they do, which is not be evil. So they try not to collect data. They embrace encryption. They let users control their own data and where it's stored. And so I think there's been a huge takeoff on that because people have become much more privacy focused. And the sad part of it is you can't be you can be a generalist and probably be okay, but you can't be, most people aren't even generalists when it comes to technology. They look at it as tools. And so they are trusting in the vendors to not be evil and those types of things. So, you know, the other thing is when we have events like CES, and I imagine 2022 it may be less than 2021, but it's going to be more of 2021 and the things that go on. And, you know, really are not only from a value for businesses to attend these events, which cost them tens of thousands of dollars. Should we still be having these events? You know, it wasn't too long ago, 10 years ago, when most of the big vendors quit attending the multi-vendor events like CES. And I think the reason CES survived is because it is the consumer electronics show. So you're not dealing with business systems, but everybody, VMware, Apple, Microsoft, AWS, they all hold their own events throughout the year, you know, that are tailored for their products and their solutions, and they're not necessarily not multi-vendor events, but it's usually wrapped around their ecosystems, whether it's a consumer ecosystem or a larger ecosystem like Apple's, or you know, an ecosystem like VMware, you know, for the data center. So those events get to be very specific. So what do you think, Matt? Should we still be holding these in-person, large in-person events? I mean, they're fun to attend, but they're also really expensive to attend.
I think a lot of this sort of thing is better done with an online event rather than an in-person event.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because really what you're talking about is major announcements of product development and whatnot. And quite frankly, other than the thrill of being in the same room with new technology, what difference does it really make?
Yeah, I mean, the only part that I can see, particularly like a show like CES, is there's no hands-on with the demos to see if the product is really real. Because on an online event, you know, and CGI being as good as it is today, you know, some Chinese phone maker could make this amazing device and claim that they're producing it and it's not real.
That's the only aspect of it that I think is still remotely valid. And those kinds of things, I think you could do those regionally.
Well, I think the way you get around that is that you have so many number of units that you can send out to people who, you know, the tech media who cover the tech world, let them review them.
You know, back in the day, I worked for an asset management company that lented out demo machines for customers to get image data and decide whether or not they were going to make that purchase.
Mm-hmm.
And that was for a fairly large, big name company in the computer world, or at least it used to be.
They're just Chinese now.
Well, true. But when I really worked for them, they were still Big Blue.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I mean, I worked for them when they became Red Chinese. But I still like to say that I worked for Big Blue. Well, as a contractor for Big Blue, I should say. It's not unheard of, is what I'm getting at. I mean, that's not a model that can't be done.
Yes. Yes. Well, and, you know, and most companies do that anyway. They, particularly if it's either they've announced a product, and so the tech media, you know, the Walt Mossbergs and of the world, and the you know, they get demo machines to use for anywhere from 2 to 3 days to 2 to 3 months prior to them actually shipping to consumers, so that they can say, oh, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. You know, and so that's not uncommon. And again, like I said, that whole hands-on experience can be ameliorated to some degree by providing it to the media. Now, a lot of the things that show up at CES are not, one, they're not mass produced enough to have 10 or 20 to send out, or they're not ready for, you know, for closer inspection or use.
Well, sure. It's kind of like the Detroit Auto Show in that respect, in that you're talking about concept cars. And so here you're talking about concept technology a lot of times, and so you're not in a position where you could loan that technology out.
Yep.
I get that.
Yeah.
But again, that's even in that case, it's better to do that in an online event rather than in person, I think.
Yeah, I do. I agree. I mean, you can provide a lot more detail. You can provide text that people can go reference back. You don't have to create a whole bunch of collateral to give out.
Yeah.
A lot of people may or may not use, so there's an environmental factor there. I'm not sure. I've never been to CES, so I'm not sure how much collateral those businesses give out there. But I imagine there is some paper collateral. I mean, we still see it at things like supercomputing, you know. Heck, the funny thing about going to supercomputing this year, I felt sorry for some of the booths. Because it was supposed to be an all-in-person event, and then because of COVID, the big boys, Intel and NVIDIA and AMD, they all decided, hey, we're gonna do our part online.
Yeah.
And but it did give a chance for a lot of the smaller vendors to come in and show off their wares and get FaceTime with a few customers who were there. What I found, what I was sorry for is like IEEE, you know, which is an organization, an engineering organization, their booth, they had tons of collateral and tons of tchotchkes to give away, and nobody came by their booth at all.
Oh.
And part of it was is just because there weren't any customers. And you know, there's also customer sessions, education sessions going on. So the showroom or the exhibitors hall is dead during, you know, large periods. And you know, typically when you have a well-attended show, the customers now come in during their breaks and, you know,
right,
and stuff. And because there weren't that many, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of interaction between like organizational exhibitors than the people who were there. Cause a lot of the manufacturers of gear for that space, they actually had meetings planned, you know, customers had set up meetings. And so they were actually getting something out a lot more out of, even though their booths were not necessarily busy.
I should revise and extend my remarks on answering the question. Mm-hmm. The question you asked me was, should we be doing these events? Now, should versus could is the question. Could we do these events? Yes. Should we do these events? I mean, you have to make a business case for that.
Yeah.
But don't let COVID be the reason why we don't do these things.
True.
There's no reason for that.
True. Well, let's move on. One of the things that's interesting that's happening, it started actually on the 4th, 3rd or 4th of this month, is some old tech is coming back to the new world. It's a little bit changed. But a cargo ship, and I'll give you a little background. So cargo ships, you know, the big container ships that bring, you know, the ones that are 100 deep out at the ports of L.A. and Long Beach on our West Coast, those ships burn what is known as bunker fuel, which is a really dirty, mostly unrefined type of diesel fuel. And evidently, the cargo industry and these cargo ships, they do more CO2 emissions, not to mention other kinds of even more dangerous emissions, let's see, they move 80% of all the goods in the world are transported by 50,000 of these cargo ships.
Okay.
They're owned by big companies like Maersk and,
right,
you know, there's a handful of companies who own these 50,000 cargo ships. like I said, bunker fuel. Let me see. Bunker fuel. Not only, you know, has CO2 emissions, but then it also gives off several sulfur oxide and nitrous oxide, which are public health concerns. So places like Long Beach and LA, where you have lots of these ships come in, these 50,000 ships provide 10 to 15% of all of those emissions in the world. So by reducing these emissions, you can cut quite a bit of, you know, LA and Long Beach have, they don't let the ships idle. They bring tugs that bring them in and out. So they probably, that's because US regulations are fairly stiff on that. But other places in the world like Africa, they don't have a regulatory committee or regulatory government agency to deal with this stuff, and I'm not going to talk whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing, but there's no regulations, so these, you know, ships typically idle. They don't have a lot of tugs that bring them into ports. So, you know, the idea is to eliminate not only CO2, which their CO2 emissions are greater than the entire worldwide airline industry.
Wow. I guess I shouldn't be surprised by that, but I kind of am.
So, this company, what are they called? They're called Airseas, and they've created a giant kite or sail. It's a parafoil.
Right.
But it's huge. It's, these parafoils are 500 square meters or 5,280 square feet. The one that they're testing right now. And they've got a small fleet of ships. I think it's 5 to 10 ships that they're testing these on. But basically, they're using these parafoil kites attached to the ships by 505 feet cables to see, you know, to reduce the emissions of the engines and make these ships a little more efficient. Right now, the I guess the main boat that they're working on is a container ship that transports airline parts between the U.S. and France on its, and they're testing these on the regular routes. Not, you know, they're not making special routes up to,
right,
to prove this. They're trying to test it on regular routes. And I guess over the next 6 months, they're going to determine how effective it is. And also, while they're doing that, they have another parafoil kite to put on ships that's twice as big. So it's 1,000 square meters.
Wow.
And they believe that that kite will reduce ship emissions by 20%. So a fifth of what they're giving off with the addition of a 1,000 square meter kite. Now, it's not a new idea. Back in the late 70s when the oil crisis was going on, they talked about refitting cargo ships with sail, you know, traditional sails. I think they did some testing. I think what they found, though, is that the traditional sail model didn't work well with these giant cargo ships. They could go with the smaller and mid-size, but right, it was not practical for these giant container ships. Whereas these parafoil kites can work with these giant container ships with essentially no change to the vessel. You know, basically you're putting a winch on the front with a very, very strong cable that holds this kite. I also don't think it probably requires a whole lot of extra training for the crew, which was an issue with the sailing idea, yeah, putting sails, because you had a crew who was used to a powered ship, and now you're going to have to teach them how to raise sails and lower sails and troubleshoot all of that, the mechanicals for that. And you're also talking about a time when electric motor efficiency wasn't as great, so automating some of this stuff was not as easy to do on a giant vessel.
Here's my concern. Now, clearly they'll have traditional backup propulsion systems.
Well, and this isn't to completely replace the engines on those engines will still be needed. And I think part of the reason they go with the parafoil design is, unlike a traditional sail, which is on a mast, and then you have to tack into the wind and all this other stuff, the parasail can be moved without the ship actually changing course.
Yeah.
So the idea is that it makes the engine more efficient because it's providing motive power in addition to the...
I get all that, but the Atlantic in particular is not forgiving.
Very true. Very true.
I worry about how sturdy this technology is, and will it be able to stand the rigors?
I think it will. You know, it's kind of interesting.
This sounds very fragile to me. It does. It sounds very fragile to me, and I can't imagine that.
I don't find it
overly successful.
Nearly as fragile as like the solar sails we've deployed in space.
Yeah,
you know,
I feel the same way about that.
And those have been quite successful.
Yeah.
You know, the in doing the research on this, there wasn't a lot of detail on how the technology was built and things like that. And I find that it's probably fairly sturdy, and it will probably, the 6 month shakedown with the few ships that they're doing this with, will probably mean they'll make engineering changes.
I would think so.
Things as well. What I'm more curious about is really how successful it will be. You know, assuming a 500 square meter, unless it's an exponential function, which again, they didn't say, if a 1,000 square meter sail can reduce emissions by 20%, that would mean a half that. Well, that's the problem. We should see like a 5% decrease on a 500 square meter sail, because it's a quarter of the.
You would think, yeah. Assuming the math holds, which.
Yeah. But like you said, it's unforgiving. The Atlantic Ocean is fairly unforgiving. What does it do? How do they deal with foul weather? When do they determine to deploy or stop using the sail? You know, because that's a fairly large thing,
yeah.
That could pull. You know, if the wind shifts, and it could pull the ship off course or pull it under the water. Or, you know, who knows. But I think it's cool.
To me, even the bigger thing is, what happens when that cable snaps? Then you've got a totally rogue, fairly large device that could do some damage, I would think.
Yeah, you know, I agree. I don't know.
I would think that the cable is sufficiently weighted.
Yeah.
But...
Well, as more detail comes out...
We'll know more.
Because, you know... What I like about this solution is that it's a solution that doesn't really require regulation.
Yeah.
It's like we're putting a sail back on the ship, you know? And the, you know, because of the mass of these cargo vessels and the mass of the containers that are on them, you know, this sail has to be fairly large to get enough surface area to be able to make a change in motive power.
But, you know, the thing that will ultimately sell the solution is whether or not it actually affects the bottom line, and I mean fiscal bottom line, of these companies, because they're not going to do it on their own.
Well, and the reason they use bunkers...
And the ecological ramifications,
that's just the
does
side.
Not affect the bottom line.
No.
It's the bottom line that's going to ultimately decide whether or not this solution gets... to be widespread.
I agree. But, you know, the reason they use bunker fuel is it's basically the least refined fuel that you can buy.
Sure.
And so it's cheap because there was less money in the process of refining the fuel. If they can get a 20% increase... you know, a motive power or they see a drop in fuel use by 20%, even if they see a 5%, 5% is going to change the bottom line enough,
yeah,
that the cost of these sales will be, and use of these sales will be valuable. And, you know, and efficiency, as we put more time and effort and competition comes out, you know, and comes up with other solutions, or a combination of solutions. You know, maybe you use a parafoil kite and you use traditional sails, or you use some other kind of way to get, you know, garner motive force, and, you know, from the natural environment. I mean, there's all kinds of things you could do. But cargo ships will be the tip of the iceberg. I think you'll start seeing cruise ships and other large vessels start using this because, again, not because of the environmental or ecological advantages. That's just a beneficial side effect. It'll be because it can reduce
the cost
significantly. Because a 5% savings in fuel would be pretty huge.
Yeah, I particularly in the freight business, but I could see that impacting the commercial.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well,
into that too.
We'll keep tracking this one because to me
it's interesting.
It's interesting. You know, it's the application of known technology in a new way.
Indeed. Which we always encourage.
Exactly.
Innovation is a key concept to the advancement of our civilization.
Yep. So, Microsoft, for the new year, released a new feature enhancement for Microsoft Exchange.
Is it really a bug?
Oh, it's a feature enhancement. It keeps Microsoft... It is the most secure email system in the world because it doesn't send any email.
Love it.
So, basically, it's a similar issue to a problem they had 22 years ago. So... For Y2K, so they actually called this problem the Y2K22 feature.
Nice.
Basically, Exchange servers across the globe stop sending email, and it has to do with their malware scanning engine. The way they name the updates used a 31-bit field, and as of January 1st, 2022, that field used up all the numbers in their malware naming update. So basically the updates, when it clock ticked over to 1201, all the updates said, oh, we don't have a new update for the malware engine, and so it holds all the email because it can't scan. Microsoft Exchange is one of Microsoft's key products. You know, whether you run... And it seemed to really only affect the standalone version that they sell to corporations and the government and stuff. It did not seem to affect their own Office 365 Exchange servers and stuff like that. So, basically, the anti-malware software queued up the messages on the servers, but it couldn't deliver them because it couldn't scan them. So, Microsoft has issued an official fix. It took 3 days to make a fix. So, luckily, it happened on a Saturday, Sunday, so it was really only a one-day down for their customers. But, again, how does this happen? You know, it's their flagship product. Couldn't they have avoided this? You know, but, you know, Microsoft has gone away from doing QA, and I thought QA they were mostly doing away with on Windows itself, you know, the client, but it seems that they're doing it on all their flagship their flagship products as well. What I'm really curious to find out is if in the people who still use standalone Exchange servers, if it's driving them to look at alternatives. Because the problem, you know, back in the late 90s, when Exchange started becoming prominent, there were other solutions out there. There was Lotus Notes from IBM.
Yep.
You had, I forget what the mail product was from Novell Netware, GroupWise, I think is what their product was called. But, you know, that did... calendaring, scheduling, email, you know, there were a handful of major products, and there were probably 20 or 30 minor products out there that competed with Exchange. And then as Exchange became dominant everywhere, a lot of those products died. You know, I think Lotus might still exist.
It was not being very actively developed when I was working for them.
Yeah.
back in the day. I mean, because literally Exchange was
coming in,
was coming in and taking over. So they weren't. IBM was smart enough to read those tea leaves and get out of the that end of it sooner than probably most.
But, you know, one of the most important things for Microsoft that drives Exchange is it also Exchange drives Office.
Yeah.
And Office 365 has been, so if people are looking at alternatives, even if they're not on-site alternatives like Exchange can be, there's that potential, if somebody goes, well, we were looking to go cloud on this anyway, we're going to pick Google, Google Docs and branded Gmail. Or, there's several of them out there. But, none of them have the integration with
And that's what
the
Microsoft
entire Office suite, which is what makes it. I mean, I've always thought Exchange and Office are good products for Microsoft.
Saying a lot because Microsoft has been not exactly a paragon.
But the relevance of Office has gotten has shrunk because there have become lots of good alternatives to it. So, you have LibreOffice, an open source. You have iWork, Apple's Office suite that they give away with every Mac and every iPad and every iPhone. You have Google Docs, which is, of all of them I have had to use, it's my least favorite. But if you were, and part of the reason it's my least favorite is there's no hard clients for anything but Chrome OS and Android. And so if you need to use it when it's offline, that's the downside of Google Docs. But in a corporate world where all people are using is email, presentations, word processing, and spreadsheets, a Chromebook can do all that fairly well. And, and Dell and HP have started selling business level Chromebooks. And my uncle uses he uses a Mac for his workshop, where he repairs appliances and clocks and jewelry and stuff. But he mostly uses a really, really nice Asus 15-inch Chromebook because, again, it can run Android apps. It has Google Docs right there. He can even run Microsoft Office on it if using the Android versions, which are free.
Yep.
So there's not a lot of compelling reasons for him to want to go and get a... He doesn't need a Mac because he's not doing... Or, he doesn't need a MacBook to because that's what he used to use, because he doesn't need all the extra functionality because he doesn't do content creation or he's not doing big engineering drawings and he's not doing... But when he needs to surf the web to do research or watch YouTube videos or, do simple office things, that Chromebook is perfect for him. And he never has to worry about updates. He never has to worry about viruses. He should worry, but you know what I mean. There's not a lot targeting a Chromebook because it's essentially like an Android phone that's locked down. Much more locked down than an actual Android phone. That's the funny part of it. But, it's a tool that does the job he needs it to do. And Windows is by far becoming... It's more of a science project half the time than it is a tool.
Can't disagree with that.
And Windows 10.11, Windows 11, put new lipstick on that pig, but it's the same pig underneath. Well, let's move on to our last thing. And I think this is something that will affect everybody in the United States and something we'll probably see in a relatively short period, might actually start seeing being implemented by the end of 2022. And that is a federal court ruling will finally make Wi-Fi 6E, which is an even faster version of Wi-Fi, a reality within the United States. In December, between Christmas and New Year's, the U.S. Court of Appeals and the District of Columbia issued a ruling where it supported the FCC's decision to divvy up 1,200 megahertz of spectrum in the 6 gigahertz band for unlicensed use. And basically what this will do is it'll allow... Right now, there's only 400 megahertz of spectrum for all of Wi-Fi to use. By adding 1,200 megahertz of spectrum, we now quadruple the amount of available bandwidth of that Wi-Fi can use. Plus, it'll stop congestion. It'll increase the speeds that devices can talk back and forth to Wi-Fi. So that is a material change that people will actually see. And people will go, well, yeah, you know, what? So what if my phone or my tablet or, you know, it's fast enough now? I'll tell you why it's important. Because the industry wants to move past 4K. And it won't go directly to 8K, even though that technology is already there and being sold. We're going to start seeing 6K, 5K, and then 6K. And those TVs are going to require even faster bandwidth. And so will your Roku boxes. And frankly, I see the cable companies get finally, probably over, even more so over the next year, moving away from considering themselves a television provider to what they really are, which is an internet service provider. And the television stations you will watch will be on an app that exists on whether you use a Roku or a their box or whatever. And it will no longer be something that is transmitted over the cable television wire in a compressed format. Because what the cable companies are finding is that nobody wants to watch their stuff, because even if they say they offer 4K, it's compressed so much that the quality isn't nearly as good as what you get on Netflix or Paramount Plus or any of the streaming services that offer 4K. And that even includes, you can see actual differences between like 1080p, you know, from one of the internet streaming services versus what's over a cable box. So, you know, this is just kind of moving that consumer market forward. And since everybody likes the idiot box, you know, it's a technology that people demand. It's bread and circuses, baby.
I got nothing for that. I mean, literally, it anything that will help defeat cable is good in my book.
Me too. Well, I think that wraps up our bicentennial show. Happy New Year, everyone. We really appreciate, you know, all of our listeners, and glad you are, you know, if you're spending some of your time listening to us. We understand that there's lots of things that can take your focus and your time and everything. Please send us some feedback to gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.